Last July, the president of Peregrine Financial Group, Russell Wassendorf Sr., admitted to stealing millions of dollars from his firm. This week, Wassendorf was sentenced to 50 years in prison. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll talk about the Wassendorf case and discover the financial, personal, and societal impact of this type of monetary fraud. My guests, Victor Epstein, the business reporter at the Des Moines Register, and Pete Deegan, public information officer at the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. Then in the second half hour, a conversation with renowned science writer Margaret Wertheim, who will be visiting Iowa next week. That's all coming up this hour after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, a federal judge sentenced the former CEO of a collapsed Iowa brokerage firm to 50 years in prison. Russell Wassendorf Sr. was the mastermind of a scheme that siphoned millions of dollars from customers' accounts. Last July, the 64-year-old confessed in a suicide note that he'd forged documents, stolen more than $200 million from clients of his Peregrine Financial Group. He also admitted that he lied to federal regulators for more than 20 years. After his failed suicide attempt, he was convicted at trial. Wassendorf has been given the maximum sentence for those charges, 50 years in prison. A bankruptcy judge is now faced with how to divvy up the company's remaining assets. Joining me to discuss the case and its fallout, Victor Epstein is with us in our Des Moines studio, business reporter at the Des Moines Register. Victor, welcome.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us by phone, the public information officer at the United States Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Iowa, Pete Deegan. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Ben.
I want to invite our listeners, too. We know there are thousands of victims of the Peregrine Financial scandal. If you're a victim of the Peregrine Financial scandal, maybe you'd like to share your story. 1-866-780-9100. Tell us the impact it will have on your life going forward. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Victor, if I can start with you, Russell Wassendorf Sr. was putting away large amounts of creditors' money for, what, 20 years? How was he doing this? Give us a timeline from when this started.
Well, a lot of my information actually comes from Pete Deegan, who's on the other line.
Okay.
And my understanding is that this actually started when he bought out his partner. When this business was first getting going, they got it going in 1993, 94, and he bought out his partner. And according to the filing that Pete made, it started with, I believe it was $250,000 in funds that were stolen from customer
money. Well, let's jump over to Pete then and have you pick up the story, Pete. You can provide that timeline.
Sure. Back in the early 90s, Wassendorf was faced with a decision. His partner wanted to pull out, and he had to come up with somewhere in the range of $250,000 to keep the business going. So he didn't have the money, so he went into his customer segregated funds. These are the funds that the investors had placed with Peregrine Financial in order to be used for futures trading. He stole the money, and to hide it, he doctored up a bank statement from the bank that held the money. That was the first step in a fraud that went on for another 20 years and involved ultimately over $200 million and 13,000 victims.
So why did it take this attempted suicide for this to come to light? Are we saying there's not enough checks here, Pete?
Well, I can tell you how it ultimately did come to light, and there was something that happened before the suicide attempt. The suicide attempt happened on the morning of July 9th, 2012. The Friday before that, the regulators, the CFTC and the NFA, had insisted that Peregrine go to electronic account verification. So while Russell Wassendorf had been faking up paper forms for years in order to hide his fraud from his own accounting department as well as auditors and regulators, going forward, the regulators would have direct access to the customer segregated accounts electronically. So he knew at that point that there was no way he could beat the system anymore and that he would be caught. That's really what caused the end of the fraud. The suicide attempt followed that development.
Okay. So I wonder if Victor, maybe you can jump in here with, give us some perspective on this case. We're saying $200 million siphoned from clients of Peregrine Financial Group. How big is this when we talk about this sort of fraud?
Well, what makes this really big is not just the money, and it's a lot of money, but the timing. Because this broke July 9th was the suicide. And at the time it broke, there was a conversation happening within the futures industry, which is a $37 trillion industry. It's huge. And what they were talking about was MF Global, which was another futures commission merchant. This one was led by former New Jersey Governor John Corzine. And $1.6 billion came up missing there in November. So then the question that was going on in the community was this a one-off? Was MF Global a one-off? And so the real significance of Wassendorf and Peregrine is it indicated that there were ongoing systemic problems within the futures industry and that MF Global was not a one-off. And yet, $215 million.
That's tiny compared to, what did you say, $37 trillion futures?
Right, but it's a lot if it's yours, you know, if some of it's yours. And so we're talking about 13,000 plus investors, 200 to 300 employees, and the employees were, you know, kicked out the door basically with no notification. You know, typically if, you know, a big company closes their door, they have to give a 60-day warn notification if they're going to lay off a large amount of employees. These guys had no notice. Most of them never got their final paychecks, and they got no severance. And, of course, they were kicked out at a time when their industry was contracting. So, you know, it took some of these guys still haven't found work.
Mm-hmm. What's your perspective, Pete Deegan, on the size of this scandal?
Well, we're confident that it's the largest white-collar fraud that has occurred in the state of Iowa. We don't know of any that would be larger. There have been some that are larger nationwide. We also think that in all likelihood, it's the largest number of victims of an offense ever committed in the state of Iowa. So this certainly is an extremely large fraud. These crimes are very damaging.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the people. I did throw out the possibility that anybody can call up and share their loss, 1-866-780-9100. Not really expecting people to take that. And there are so many victims here. Victor, you've spoken with some groups of people most affected, but are reticent to share their stories. Perhaps you could share some of them.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I'd be delighted to. But I also want to note that, you know, you don't have to be an Iowa farmer to invest with Peregrine. And in many cases, what it was is people investing with a local broker who then executed transactions through Peregrine. Many of them were from outside of this country. And it was, you know, we were originally told, hey, you're going to see a lot of farmers, a lot of grain silos that were using Peregrine to hedge. Whether those this not finding them was a case of they don't exist or not finding them was a case of they don't want to come forward. They don't want, you know, clients to know that this happened to them. I can't say. It's probably a little bit of both. Right. But again, a lot of victims from overseas. And in terms of victims, you know, the ones that I've talked to mostly are brokerages, and some of them just devastated by this because who's going to trust you after they give you $1 million? Maybe that's their retirement. And all of a sudden it's just, you know, well, let's say 55 or 65% of it's gone. And they didn't do anything wrong, and neither did their advisor. And so that's – I've talked with folks at Attain Capital in Chicago. That happened to them. I think it's DeCarli Trading in Las Vegas that happened to them. Some very interesting stories from the employees. There's a guy named Ron Katulak who used to be what's called a balancing officer at Peregrine. He just got a full-time job 2 weeks ago, and I think, you know, you're talking about 7 months have gone by. Mm-hmm. But the funniest story, if it's okay to tell a funny story and something so sad, was actually his son. And his son was 18 at the time this happened, and it was his first day as an intern at Peregrine's offices in Chicago. And I think the young man's name is Ben. And Ben told me that he was working there for 3 hours, and the whole idea was to spend time with Dad and go back and forth to work and have lunch with Dad. You know, he's getting older. He's going to be moving out of the house, going to college and all that. And he wasn't there 3 hours, and the whole firm collapsed, his first business experience.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he joked around afterwards that he was afraid to work anywhere again because he didn't want to bring down another business.
Okay.
Now, Pete can tell you some stories about some of the individual investors. I believe there were some that he mentioned. There were people for whom this was retirement money.
Yeah, Pete, please do tell us about a few of those people.
Well, there were some comments that I made in court yesterday regarding some of the things that the victims had said. One of them wrote that this was retirement money that couldn't be replaced. Another victim had set aside money that was lost that was supposed to be used to help support a developmentally disabled adult child. So there's when you talk about 13,000 victims, every one of them is going to have a story. And none of the stories are good. Getting back to sort of the nature of the victims as well, one of the things that was particularly disturbing about this was in the case of at least one victim that was discussed yesterday in court, there was a victim that had her account bought up by PFG, just sort of in the sort of natural progression of these FCMs, these futures commission merchants. They buy up accounts from other FCMs or
and
other.
And she was aware
brokers.
Of it when that happened?
Well, she wasn't. Her account simply got bought up. And then a couple months went by. The fraud came to light, and all of a sudden she's a victim as well. That's a little bit alarming that kind of thing could happen.
So some of these 13,000 victims just they made no decision. They invested perhaps initially in worthwhile investments, and then these investments were carried out by these financial professionals, and without knowing, all of a sudden you're a victim.
That's correct, and it's a little bit different in this type of these type of investments because the money is often set aside. The law requires that the money be segregated so that futures trades are backed up when the time comes to decide whether or not they're actually going to be exercised or not. So these FCMs hold a lot of money on behalf of their investors, liquid, actual dollars. That's right. Why the law requires they have to be segregated, okay. And that's why it's monitored so carefully.
And then the question, Pete, that comes to my mind, and I'm sure many listeners, is, okay, I have my money investment. How can I check that this won't happen to my money, or are there safeguards in place that prevent this?
Well, I would say to the investor that has concerns like that, they need to talk to their who's ever responsible for investing their money for them. Talk to their broker to see exactly where their money is, mm-hmm. So that they can keep careful track of where it is. I will add too, this isn't probably the type of investment that a lot of people may have. So it's probably not something that maybe the average investor is necessarily needs to be worried about. But certainly folks that are in the futures market need to know who's actually placing their money for them.
Victor Epstein, one of the hallmarks of this case is the Wassendorf's lifestyle. The 64-year-old Marion native pilfered these funds to live lavish lifestyle and expand the business. First of all, was that business ever profitable on its own?
Well, again, citing Pete, because I'm a big fan of Pete because he gives me stories, it was never profitable. And he could not have stayed in business without the money that he was tapping. And then segueing into his lifestyle, I don't know how he found time to do anything but buy stuff. I've never seen anybody who owned as many things as he owned. And I've covered a lot of wealthy people in the course of my career. He had lots of stuff, and some of it was just really confusing. There was so much stuff that the auctioneers had to ask for extra time to prepare all the items. And I think it took them something like 14 or 16 hours to auction all of it off.
And so some of the more curious objects? Do either of you have a...
I think in this case, Pete, did you get a chance to see the stuff?
Well, you know what? I think I'll just defer to you on this one, okay. Victor. Because that's all been handled by the receiver and the trustee.
I got a chance to see a lot of stuff. I mean, some of the weirder stuff is he had like a baby blue 1954 T-Bird automobile, which is something straight out of that film American Graffiti. Mm. And so you got to figure, well, that was some kind of touchstone, either the film or the period it covered in his life. So instead of just buying the film, he bought the car. And, you know, that was something we saw over and over again. Instead of renting, you know, a front-end loader, he bought himself. I think he had two front-end loaders. And, you know, you're like, why does this guy have two front-end loaders? He had four. I think he had four snowmobiles. And he had six sets of professional camera equipment that made my photographer drool, photographer David Purdy, who did such a great job on the auction story. And it was just on and on. I mean, gratuitous. Living the high life, the best of everything, buying stuff that you could have just rented. And the funniest thing is his house wasn't really that big, but it was attached to a swimming pool that would have been suitable for a college swim team. I mean, he had a glass enclosed swimming pool with, I won't even go into the details. It was probably worth twice as much as the house. And the locker rooms were like for 16 people each. The sauna was for 12 people. And you're just walking around, you're thinking, who needs all this stuff? You know, the basement of his house had a piano bar in it. And then his restaurants, nothing but the best for his restaurants. I think between his wine cellar in his house and the wine cellar in the restaurant, we're looking at 4,000 bottles of wine. Mm-hmm. They're not cheap bottles of wine.
I remember years ago, many years ago, actually going to one of his restaurants, the one in downtown Cedar Falls. Maybe you can remember the...
Verona. I bet it was really good.
Yeah. I walked in there, and you know, that's my hometown, Cedar Falls. I walked in there, and my first reaction was, I'm no longer in Cedar Falls anymore. I thought I was in New York City.
Well, I think that's what he was going for. But see, then again, there's a departure with Wassendorf from what you usually see in businesses, which is he didn't need to run a profit because he's not paying for this with his own money. He's just tapping into customer funds. And so there was nothing that was too expensive. And I think there was one of the gentlemen out in Cedar Falls sells bail bonds. I saw him touring the estate. And he said the funniest thing to me. He said, you know, nothing's too expensive for the man who's not spending his own money on it.
well said. Let's go to Ann in Iowa City. She's joining us. Ann, do you have a connection with the Peregrine financial scandal?
Yeah. A number of my friends worked at the restaurant you were just describing, and many of them are still waiting for their last paycheck.
Really?
And so it didn't affect just the investors. It affected a lot of working class people who were then late on rent and late on bills And it also affected there's more victims than just the investors.
Did they share any other details of what it was like to work in one of his restaurants? Was he, for example, around very much in the restaurant?
You know, I don't know if he was around, but they all loved him. One of them, for example, got sent on a trip to Italy to learn how to cook. I mean, he spent extravagant amounts of money on the employees, as you were saying, because it wasn't his money.
Interesting.
Ann,
thank you.
Too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's particularly interesting is that the restaurant itself, not only didn't Russ Wassendorf or PFG ever make any money, but the restaurant itself lost money. So this kind of frivolous spending is something that Wassendorf did. And as Victor mentioned, it was all with his customers' invested funds. It was all stolen money.
Okay, so what can we say about the state of mind of the type of person, the state of mind of someone who does this? You took us back on the timeline way back, Pete Deegan, when he needed this $250,000 and he dipped into these off-limit funds. What can you say about the mindset of someone who is criminally doing this?
Well, I guess I can say some of the things that we learned during our investigation and some of the things that he told us about that. At some point, he knew that he was going to get caught. There was not going to be any way he could pay back all the money he had stolen, so he was going to have to continue to conceal it going forward. And one of the ways he would have to continue to conceal the fraud would be by continuing to run a business that wasn't profitable, which means he's going to have to steal more money. Another thing that would have been going through his mind as well is, you know, as he's running the business and as he's spending things going forward and the amount is getting bigger and bigger, he knows that he's going to have to continue to bring in more investor money so that he has the funds available to run the business,
right,
and to sort of support his lifestyle. He did say that he spent he wanted to make make it appear as though he was a very wealthy person because he felt that it would make the auditors and the regulators not look so closely and not discover the fraud.
Tell a big enough lie and they won't look behind it.
That was his theory.
Mm-hmm. In the discussions with him, any sense of remorse? Obviously, if you're going to take your own life, you're remorseful about something, but I mean about the victims.
Sure, and I'll say that he did leave a suicide note that was part of the record in the court proceeding where he did talk about his feelings of remorse for the victims and for his customers. In that note, though, and this was something that was discussed yesterday by myself and as well as Chief Judge Reed, who imposed the sentence, in that suicide note, he did say he didn't have any remorse for the regulators, for the CFTC and the NFA. He felt, as he expressed in his suicide note, that he was a victim of their overly aggressive and, in his view, vindictive regulation.
I'm trying to even begin to understand that one.
It's difficult to understand.
Before we have to go, Victor Epstein, you've been dealing with this story for quite a while. And any details that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to bring out?
Well, I will say that this is, I've been in journalism for more than 30 years, and this is one of the more surreal stories. So many twists and turns in this thing, and I think the suicide notes are very important. You know, we got to remember what it takes to be successful in the investing world. And really, it's not just business knowledge, but it's an opportunistic personality and the ability to identify opportunities. And there's a fine line between identifying opportunities that are lawful and identifying opportunities that are unlawful. And of course, you know, we've seen people crossing that line a great deal in the run-up to the Great Recession and in the years that followed it. And I think the thing to keep in mind is these guys are very intelligent. They run big companies that are full of intelligent people. You know, I'm a pretty good business reporter, but I'd be lying if I didn't say I was overmatched by these guys. And I think to a certain extent it's true of the folks on Pete's side too. These guys are very sophisticated. If these suicide notes hadn't been there, he probably still would have been caught, but how he did it would have been very hard. And let's keep in mind that Madoff, who's another example, if his sons hadn't turned him in, who knows what would have happened. We've seen people get away with large thefts because it was too hard to catch him. And I'm not going to name names because if somebody hasn't been arrested, it's probably inappropriate to do that. But no one's been arrested for what happened at MF Global.
Pete Deegan, sorry to cut you off, Victor. Sure. We've got just a few seconds left. Pete Deegan, what I want to know most now before we go in the 30 seconds we have, will there be any additional charges? Are there – hard to believe there aren't others who knew about this who were involved.
Well, at this point, we don't anticipate additional charges, although the FBI is going to continue to look into this matter very closely going forward. They do have a lot of records, and the bankruptcy trustee and the receiver are looking over their records as well. So, but at this point, we don't anticipate additional charges.
Okay. I want to thank you very much, Pete Deegan, for joining us, public information officer at the United States Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa. Pete, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Victor Epstein, thank you very much for joining us, business reporter at the Des Moines Register. For those interested, I imagine people can go to the Des Moines Register website and simply look up your name for the series that you've been the reporting on you've done on this.
Yes, thanks for having me. There's a ton of auction photos on the website. Some of the stuff's really interesting to look at.
Victor Epstein, thank you very much. Coming up in just a moment, in the second half of our program, a conversation with renowned science writer Margaret Wertheim. Talk about science education, women in science, a couple of the topics coming up in just a moment. Margaret Wertheim will be visiting Iowa next week, Coe College in Cedar Rapids. That's when we come back. Margaret Wertheim, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is internationally renowned science writer and commentator Margaret Wertheim. Her work includes extensive texts about science and society for magazines, television, and for radio. She's also the author of several books, including Pythagoras's Trousers, A History of the Relationship Between Physics, Religion, and Women, The Pearly Gates of Cyberspace, A Cultural History of Space from Dante to the Internet, and her latest, Physics on the Fringe, which looks at the idiosyncratic world of outsider physics. These are people with little or no scientific training who develop their own alternative theories of the universe. Margaret Wertheim will be speaking next week, next Friday, February 8th, as part of the Coe College Marquee series, beginning at 7:30 in Sinclair Auditorium. Margaret Wertheim, thank you for joining us.
Lovely to be here, Ben.
I wonder if you can give us any kind of preview of the talk you'll be giving next Friday in Cedar Rapids.
Well, what I'm going to be talking about is a project that I've been doing for the last 7 years to crochet a coral reef. You know, most people who hear about that think it's a bit mad. Why are these people crocheting a coral reef? And the reason is that we're trying to bring attention to the plight of coral reefs and marine organisms all over the world who are being devastated by global warming. And it turns out that all these frilly crenellated structures that we see so much as a part of coral reefs, they're biological manifestations of a kind of geometry known as hyperbolic geometry. And the best way to make models of that, believe it or not, is with crochet.
Really? Now, and this is one of the projects of your Institute for Figuring, which you and your twin sister Christine founded in 2003. Where does this crocheted coral reef exist?
We've been doing the crochet coral reef all over the world. It first started in our living room in Highland Park in Los Angeles, but gradually we've worked with communities all over the USA, in New York and Chicago and Scottsdale, Arizona, and many, many other cities and states. And we've worked with people in countries all over the world, including in Australia, England, Ireland, Latvia, Germany, many, many other countries. The reef is gradually growing into a worldwide phenomenon.
As a landlocked area, Iowa, with 1,000 miles probably from any sea, well, why is it relevant to us?
Well, the thing about coral reefs is, yes, they don't exist in Iowa, but we've done them in other landlocked places like Scottsdale, Arizona. But the real issue here is that it's a way of bringing attention to the plight of the whole world due to global warming. Coral reefs are really evidently being affected by global warming, and the devastation of reefs like the Great Barrier Reef is proof that global warming is not something in the future, it's here and now, it's affecting the Earth right as we speak. So the real point of this project is to bring attention to global warming.
In fact, Iowa does have something to do with coral reefs, Margaret.
Yes.
We have, not far from where you'll be speaking, we have a town, in fact, called Coralville. And that's named after the magnificent coral reef that used to be part of a large body of water in the middle of the North American continent millions of years ago.
Yes, well, I was going to say that is very likely because, in fact, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, corals occupied vast portions of planet Earth, and many, many places that are now deserts or are now inland do have, you know, deep deposits of coral in their fossil records.
Now, this crocheted coral reef is, as I mentioned, part one of the project of your Institute for Figuring, which is in Los Angeles, where you are. And I see it's described as an organization that promotes the public understanding of the poetic and aesthetic dimensions of science and mathematics. Describe some other ways in which you go about doing that.
What we do with the Institute for Figuring is that we want to engage people with scientific and mathematical themes by giving them activities to do that allow them to build and make things through almost artistic processes. So another one of the projects that we have done, or in fact that we're doing right now, is we're getting people to build mathematical structures like fractals out of business cards.
What's a fractal?
A fractal is a mathematical object that basically has the property of what's called self-similarity. So if you take a little tiny piece of the object and blow it up, it's as complicated as a whole. So fractals are these strange geometrical objects that mathematicians began to discover about 100 years ago. Well, at first they thought they were, they shouldn't exist. They were kind of a mathematical anomaly. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that, in fact, lots of things in nature are fractals. So the branching of trees, the forking of lightning, the way that earthquakes fracture rock, all of these happen in fractal structures. So clouds and coastlines and ferns, they're all fractal structures too. So fractals are actually very, very important in nature. And we're currently exploring at the IFF what other kinds of mathematical structures you can make by folding business cards together. And we're just letting people play, and people are doing amazingly beautiful things and coming up with structures of their own. So it's like a kind of, as it were, an exercise in art and mathematics. You take these techniques that were inspired by mathematics, but then you let people play, and they do all kinds of creative things that we would never have, you know, imagined.
It sounds like a lot of fun, Margaret, but I wonder, is there a point to it as well?
Well, it's a lot of fun, but yes, there's a pedagogical point in that we really do want to teach people. We want people to learn things about mathematics and science through these processes, and the whole purpose of the Institute for Figuring is to say that maths and science need not be these scary, alienating activities. They are beautiful activities, and you can, as it were, learn math and science through these beautiful material processes.
Mm-hmm. And also reminding you, if you're on a walk or you're on a beach, that you are surrounded by incredible and beautiful mathematics all the time.
Yes, and I think one of the things to bear in mind is that in the contemporary world that we live in, mathematics and science in so many ways have become integral and important parts of our society. There is so much that science and engineering are creating that are changing the very way that we live, everything from microchips that come out of quantum mechanics to lasers that also come out of quantum mechanics to all these telecommunications technologies. These are created by an understanding of mathematics and science.
You grew up in Australia. You're from Australia. You've lived in the United States for how many years?
22 years.
Have you been to our classrooms, our public school classrooms, in science classrooms to really look at why we are in many ways failing in our science education?
I've been to a lot of college classes. I haven't actually spent much time in high school classes. I did, before I came to the U.S., I made a television series about mathematics and science aimed at teenage girls. And one of the things that is happening, I think, is that some students get access to very good math and science teachers, particularly in private schools. But in state schools, in government schools, there are very few resources to support math and science teaching. So part of the problem is that teachers' wages are very low. Math and science teaching is difficult. You know, it's a hard enough thing to absorb yourself, let alone to teach it to, you know, 30, 14-year-olds. And I think we're providing very, very little support for math and science teaching. There is actually a new initiative that's going on, which I think is really marvelous, that we need to see more of. It's called Math for America. And that program basically gives scholarships to 50 or so young math teachers every year and supports them with in teacher development, classroom support, and also just paying them more.
What you mentioned, women in science. How do you feel in particular women are faring when it comes to scientific fields and education?
Looking at women in science has been a big part of my work over the years. I wrote a book about the history of physics called Pythagoras' Trousers. And in looking at the history of physics, I also looked at how this had been a subject that has been very difficult for women to break into and still is this, the one science where women participate the least. We're doing better. There's definitely more women in physics and mathematics than there were in the past, but we're doing better very slowly, particularly physics, mathematics, computer science, engineering. They still remain very, very heavily male-dominated enterprises. And I think that there's nothing wrong with men doing these things. Of course, it's wonderful. But women have brains too. And by not encouraging girls to take up these sciences more, we're losing that potential, all the marvelous brain power that 51% of the population has to offer is often being not only activated in math and science, but deactivated. There's still very strong, persistent feelings in our society that somehow these activities are not innately feminine. And there's a lot of work that's shown that although girls actually do better in math and science up until the end of primary school, when they hit puberty, girls suddenly plummet in these fields. And a lot of the research suggests that what happens is that girls begin to feel that they can't compete with, they shouldn't be seen to be competing with boys who they're now interested in dating.
Right.
So we need to kind of get over those stereotypes and work out ways in which we can do that.
So really, these are cultural barriers you're talking about more than anything else, that when you hit puberty as a girl in this country, you see that, pressure's on you and science is not sexy.
Yes, that's exactly. And it's not true only in America. I mean, this is true all over the Western world. It's interesting that one of the things that has been shown to work in encouraging girls into math and science is sending them to all-girls schools. So countries, it's ironic, that countries like Italy, which we think of as probably, a fairly male-dominated society, Italy actually produces quite a lot of women physicists. And the reason it's been speculated about is because the girls are getting an education on their own, in private, in girls' schools. So the girls are not themselves seeing math and science class as a place where they might be in competition with boys. They're just free to do it on their own. And it's true in America, too, that, a huge number of young women who end up being good at math and science have gone to all-girls schools.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is internationally renowned science writer and commentator Margaret Wertheim. She's written extensively about science and society for magazines, also her work on television and radio, the author of several books, her latest, Physics on the Fringe, and she'll be speaking next week in Cedar Rapids as part of Co-College's Marquee Series in Sinclair Auditorium. Well, we spoke a little bit about science education. I wonder if you see a connection between our failings in science education in this country and observations you may have about the way in which science is talked about in our national politics.
Well, I think there is a very, very problematic climate here for discussing science publicly, because there is a huge number of people who believe in creationism who think that in some sense science is a threat to their religious beliefs. And so the atmosphere for discussing science in America is much more contentious than it is in Europe or Australia. And I think that's a problem that those of us who love science and care about it really need to think about. How can we reach out and make people who are religious fundamentalists not feel threatened by science? And I believe that that's possible. I've written a lot in my career about the interrelationship between science and religion. I myself was brought up Catholic, and there was certainly no problem with believing in science from a Catholic perspective. And I think that it's a really important problem that we try to think about how we can make overtures to the fundamentalist community. I don't believe in creationism myself. I do believe in the value of religion in society. And I think it's helpful to science's cause to present religion as the enemy. Religion can be a powerful and positive thing in people's lives, and we need to find ways to bridge these divides between scientific and religious communities.
So, Margaret, let's take a concrete example. If you would meet someone one-on-one, and that person is what you might call a fundamentalist Christian and has very mm-hmm. definite views about creationism or intelligent design, how do you respect that person's religion, but yet stay true to science?
Well, there are two issues here that I think have to be considered. What do people believe and why do they believe it? And the other question is, on the basis of that religious belief, what do they have the right to do in society? Now, people have the freedom in their personal lives to believe anything. that is one of the founding principles of America, and it is one of the great ideas entrenched in the Constitution. You can believe that the world was created in 6 days, 4,000 years ago. What you don't have the right to do is to force that in that belief onto others. And I believe that creationists have every right to believe in their religious views, but we have to resist the imposition of that in school curriculum.
But a person who would be of that opinion would say, simply offering creationism to be taught in public school science classes is not forcing its way if it's taught alongside evolution.
Yes, that is what is often argued. But here's the thing. What is taught in science, in school science classrooms, is a core set of principles that the scientific community generally has agreed on. Even within science itself, there are many dissenting views on all sorts of issues. Science is not monolithic. There are many, many, many competing theories in science, in many different areas of it, held by a minority of people. We don't teach all of those competing theories on any subject in science. What we teach is a core set of principles that have been agreed on by the majority of the scientific community at this time. That is what science education is about. So if you're going to allow creationists to offer another set of views about what could be a scientific theory in the science classroom, then you open the floodgates. There are millions and millions and millions of competing, of people with outside, what I call outsider views, non-mainstream scientific views. And that's what my latest book is about. It's about people who have alternative theories of physics. Now, these people are not trained physicists, but they looked at the world themselves and decided that there are all these other ways of seeing. We don't teach any of that in the physics classroom. And most people would look at it and say, but that's just your view. You're entitled to it, but we don't teach that in school. And the same is true of creationism. Just because you claim it's an alternative scientific theory, doesn't mean you have the right to have it taught in classrooms. There are millions of alternative scientific theory by all sorts of people out there in their backyards and their home offices dreaming up their own theories of the world. If we open the floodgates and allow one set of outsider alternative theorizing, and then why don't we let a million others? We'd never get anywhere with education. Education by its very nature, particularly science education, has to be, in some sense, conservative. It has to be the core set of views that the majority of mainstream scientists accept.
You also write about how some theories, especially in physics, are very, very complicated, even as a scientist, hard to wrap your mind around. I wonder if we could end this conversation, Margaret, with having you tell us about an area of physics that you personally find one of the hardest to comprehend.
Well, of course, understanding what general relativity is not easy for anybody. General relativity is hard. It's a very, very mathematically grounded theory. No one could have come to general relativity just by looking at the world. Mm-hmm. You have to do a lot of complicated mathematics to get there. And that complicated math seems intimidating to a lot of people. And it's hard to make sense of. But here's the thing. Using that mathematics, we make extraordinary predictions all the time that are useful. So here's an amazing thing. Every time you use a cell phone, the satellites that are, every time you use a cell phone and use GPS positioning, the satellites that are calculating the position of where you are and letting you know that there's McDonald's restaurant round the corner, those satellites are using the equations of general relativity and making slight alterations in the calculations based on general relativity to tell you exactly where you are. So even though relativity seems like this abstruse mathematical theory, it literally works. And we all use it now every time we turn on GPS positioning in our car or use it in our iPhones. And that's really a remarkable thing. Physics might seem hard and abstruse and mathematically incomprehensible to many people, but the people who have understood it have used it to give us extraordinary technologies that are really changing the ways that we live.
Margaret Wertheim, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today, and we look forward to welcoming you to Cedar Rapids next Friday evening.
That would be great, Ben. I look forward to being there.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.